From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In the province of Aceh, in which it seems to be a lot of the villages and small towns there are reporting up to 80% of the people have been killed.
At least 40,000 people have died in the world's worst tsunami in more than a century. We'll go to Indonesia, India, and the Maldives.
We have about two-thirds of the entire population affected, probably up to 100,000 homeless. 50% of them are children. Many people are being evacuated from their islands that have been either partially or totally destroyed. This is the biggest disaster the Maldives has ever had to face.
We will also speak with Sri Lanka's UN ambassador, as well as the permanent representative to the United Nations of the small island nations.
This is a total disgrace, we feel, on how we have failed as a human race to prepare vulnerable countries to this sort of type of disasters.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Sunday's devastating tsunamis in the Indian Ocean has now topped 40,000. It's expected to grow higher. As many as a third of the dead are believed to be children. Sri Lanka has put its official death toll at over 18,000 people. In Indonesia, the country's vice president is estimating that up to 25,000 people may have died in the province of Aceh alone. Thousands more have died across India, Thailand, Somalia, Malaysia, and the Maldives. Islands. Millions of people are homeless, and doctors fear epidemics could quickly spread among the displaced populations. All told, 11 nations are still recovering from the tsunamis caused by a massive underwater earthquake near Indonesia. Registering a magnitude of 9.0, it was the largest earthquake in 40 years. The resulting tsunamis were the deadliest the world has seen in over 120 years. One UN official said, quote, "This may be the worst natural disaster in recent history." Agence France-Presse reports the relief effort is the largest the world has ever seen. It will also likely be the costliest. Billions of dollars will be needed to feed and house survivors as well as rebuild cities. The Bush administration agreed to give an initial donation of $15 million, but the small amount was quickly criticized. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Jan Egeland, criticized the U.S. for being, quote, stingy. Secretary of State Colin Powell said the $15 million is just the first installment. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. In Iraq, at least 28 people, including 18 Iraqi police officers, have died in another day of violence. The deadliest attack took place near Tikrit, where gunmen killed 12 police officers. Four other attacks were waged on nearby police checkpoints. Meanwhile, in Bakuba, gunmen assassinated a local police commander. In the village of Moradia, a car bombing killed five civilians. And in Baghdad, a suicide car bomber tried to assassinate a senior Iraqi National Guard officer as he was leaving his home. The officer was unhurt in the attack, but eight others were injured. In other news from Iraq, the country's largest Sunni political party announced on Monday it is dropping out of next month's election. The move by the Iraqi Islamic Party raises new questions over how credible the election will be seen if Sunnis don't participate. On January 30th, Iraqi voters are scheduled to elect 18 provincial councils and a 275-member National Assembly that will appoint a central government and draft Iraq's constitution. The Christian Science Monitor has obtained a memo from the chief United Nations elected official that raises many alarms about the January 30th election. According to the memo, the number of new voter registrations is below expectations. The warehouses where ballots are being stored are not fully defendable from attack. The UN official also questions why Iraq is using schools as voting sites, even though some polling centers are expected to be attacked. Meanwhile, a recording purportedly of Osama bin Laden was broadcast on Al Jazeera on Monday. Bin Laden called on Sunnis to boycott the election. He said, quote, "Anyone who takes part in the election consciously and willingly is an infidel." Bin Laden also announced that al-Zarqawi was the emir of al-Qaeda in Iraq and called on Muslims to, quote, "listen to him." In other Iraq news, the country's human rights minister is reporting 10,000 detainees are now being held in U.S.-run prisons. Over 96% of the detainees are Iraqi nationals. Although U.S. officials have blamed Iran and Syria backing the Iraqi resistance, there are only 56 Syrians and 22 Iranians currently in the U.S.-run jails. There are more Egyptians and Saudis locked up than Syrians or Iranians. In Ukraine, Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych has announced he will challenge the results of Sunday's election, claiming widespread vote fraud. Yanukovych lost to opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko by a 52-44% margin. Yanukovych said he will not concede defeat and has said he will demand the results be canceled. In election news in this country, controversy continues over the presidential vote in Ohio. On Monday, Ohio's Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, requested a protective order that would shield him from being forced to answer questions about the election in a lawsuit charging widespread vote fraud. Blackwell claims that as a high-ranking public official, he should not be required to be interviewed by lawyers. Blackwell also accused the voters who are challenging the election of, quote, "frivolous conduct." Israeli police Monday detained Palestinian presidential candidate Dr. Mustafa Barghouti for the second time in a month. Police charged he was illegally campaigning by appearing in East Jerusalem. Human rights activist Dr. Barghouti is polling second in the presidential race behind PLO chief Mahmoud Abbas, who is expected to win. In news from Colombia, President Álvaro Uribe has signed into law a constitutional amendment that will allow him to run for re-election. The amendment also bars any opponents from launching their campaigns until 4 months before the presidential election. Uribe's current term expires in August 2006. Re-election would keep him in power until 2010. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, the death toll from the devastating tsunamis in the Indian Ocean has now topped 40,000, expected to grow higher. As many as a third of the dead are believed to be children. Sri Lanka has put its official death toll at over 18,000 people. In just a few minutes, we're joined by the Sri Lankan ambassador to the United Nations. But first, we go to Indonesia, to John Budd of UNICEF.
We are now beginning to get reports in, as yet unconfirmed, about the deaths that have been occurring in areas of northern Sumatra in the province of Aceh, in which it seems to be a lot of the villages and small towns there are reporting up to 80% of the people have been killed. These are very isolated areas along the Sumatran coast, which faces the Indian Ocean, so access to these areas is extremely difficult because it's very mountainous. So the mountains go right down to the sea. And we are getting these reports from the government of Indonesia, people who are on the ground and are getting out and about to see what the situation is in these areas now that they know the extent of the damage and the destruction and the deaths in the major areas. So that information is coming via our colleagues and counterparts in the government. The government of Indonesia has opened up the province to the international relief agencies to send supplies and indeed send staff in there to assess the extent of the problems and the extent of what is required. Because previous to that, it was extremely difficult to get into the province because there had been a conflict that had been waged there. So we will be sending in tomorrow, UNICEF will be going in tomorrow to make its preliminary assessment of exactly what will be required in terms of relief. In the meantime, we are sending on Friday, maybe even as early as Thursday, but certainly Friday, arriving in Indonesia will be health supplies, emergency health kits for 200,000 people to last for 2 weeks. Now, we assess at the moment, excluding the information that I just provided to you before, that 500,000 people have been affected by the tsunami. So we believe that because of that, and because the water supply has been knocked out, electricity is cut, as is most telecommunication, that's all down. We are assessing that there will be severe health problems there caused by disease and diarrhea problems very shortly. Therefore, we're sort of focusing our initial efforts on emergency health kits and hygiene kits to get to the people there, and we can get to 200,000 of the 500,000 people who are affected by this disaster. The hardest part for us will be actually distributing them on the ground because the area is essentially not in contact with the rest of the world, if you like. We are very reliant on making our estimates of what will be required. So we are basically working a little bit in the dark, but we believe that this will be absolutely vital requirements for Aceh. To tell you the extent of the damage, the UNICEF office has been knocked out there. It only took us until today to find out whether our staff member who ran there was okay. He's okay, but we still haven't found the UNICEF driver up there. So the difficulties are enormous. Like we cannot underestimate exactly how difficult it is going to be to provide relief into that area, and that is why we're proceeding quite cautiously, knowing that Bandar Aceh, the provincial capital, and the capital where all the government bureaucracy and all the government officials lie is wrecked. So therefore, it is virtually rebuilding and starting again.
John Budd with UNICEF speaking to us from Jakarta, Indonesia. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the Sri Lankan ambassador to the United Nations who joins us in our studio, Bernard Gunateleke. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about what's happening with Sri Lanka, along with Aceh, it looks like, the hardest hit of this global calamity, the worst tsunami in more than a century?
Well, despite the distance from Aceh, It appears to us that Sri Lanka has taken a direct hit, the eastern coast of Sri Lanka, southern coast of Sri Lanka, and even the western coast. We have large numbers of death and destruction to property and infrastructure. And we have not experienced this kind of natural calamity before, ever in our lifetime.
Can you place Sri Lanka geographically for, I would say, Americans, a very insulated audience?
Yes, it is easy. If you know where India is, it is directly south of India. It's a small island. Size is something like 25,000 square miles. Population, we have approximately 19 million people. And now we are speaking of 18,000 casualties. That is by counting the numbers of death. But we have also to remember the fact that massive numbers would have also would have got drowned, and with the receding waves would have gone into the sea. So the exact number of casualties, it will take some time for us to understand the magnitude of the disaster.
Exactly when did the tsunami hit?
This happened in the morning of Sunday, 26th, around 10 o'clock in the morning, Sri Lanka time.
Did you have any warning?
There was no warning whatsoever. In fact, even the people who were by the beachside, that being a holiday, would have not known what was going to happen because there are no early warning systems. And unlike in the case of cyclones, or what we call here tornadoes, or floods, which we are accustomed to, there is early warning. But this type of tidal waves, there is no, absolutely no early warning system.
And describe the area's hardest hit.
Well, Sri Lanka is populated, mainly populated in the southern side, the western side, but the impact of the tidal wave was mostly felt in the eastern coast of Sri Lanka. But despite the fact that the southern coast was also affected, we have, according to the information we have, the entire eastern coast, southern coast, as well as the part of the southwestern area, these areas have been affected, and western coast is the most populous areas of this island.
And who in particular is affected?
Well, we have large populations living in the coastal areas. First, we have the families who live by fishing, and those people would have got affected together with their fishing equipment, boats, and whatever they have used for their occupation. Then we have large numbers of tourist resorts stretched all the way along the beach from the western coast to the southern coast. And mind you, this is the season, height of the season, immediately after the Christmas. And there would have been large numbers of tourists as well as local people holidaying in those areas. So we have people living in the coastal areas as well as the tourists, both local and foreign, who would have got affected.
What about the situation with the Tamils? There's been a struggle for a long time in Sri Lanka. The Wall Street Journal is noting that Sri Lanka is one of the most heavily landmine countries in the world. UN officials fearing that the massive flooding moved many of the mines and washed away the markers.
I don't entirely agree with the statement that is the most heavily landmined areas in the world. But we have large numbers of landmine, remnants of the armed conflict which we had for about 2 years, 2 decades. Fortunately, the armed conflict came to an end. There is a ceasefire for the last 3 years, and both sides, both the government as well as the LTTE, have been cooperating with international bodies for the removal of landmines. And there has been, or there is, a campaign that is going on to remove landmines. Notwithstanding that, you have a problem of landmines. These landmines would have got dislodged from the original places and would have floated, and certainly that would be a problem for us to deal with in the weeks and months to come.
We're speaking with the ambassador from Sri Lanka at the United Nations about the devastation of the last 2 days, in a piece from the Associated Press talking about the Tamil conflict and how it's playing out right now, talking about thousands of bodies being recovered, hundreds of thousands of Sri Lankans fleeing their homes. But government troops and Tamil Tiger rebels refuse to work together to locate survivors and help victims. The article goes on to say, the Tigers control a vast part of Tamil-majority northeastern Sri Lanka as a virtual independent state with its own administration, police, and judiciary. The government controls remaining areas. A Tamil member of parliament said government leaders discussing relief efforts simply were not bothered about the plight of our people. Your response?
Well, I am not qualified to respond to that statement made by a member of the parliament representing the Tamil population. But the fact remains, the Sri Lankan government administration for the last 2 decades have had a hand in the administration, running schools and health facilities in the areas which are controlled or which are which is out of the government control. And it is not correct to say that the government has not looked into the plight of the Tamil people. We have an arrangement with the United Nations agencies, with UNICEF, UNDP, and UNHCR, with whom we cooperate and with a view to providing assistance to these areas.
They're asking for donors to give separately. What is your response
well,
to that,
this has
to the
been,
Tamil areas?
This has been the line which has been propagated by the LTT for a long time. A period of time. The fact remains, as of now, as in the past, government provide funding to the Tamil, the areas controlled by the Tamil Tigers. It is happening even today. The most important factor is where we do not go, we have permitted the UN agencies to go, and we have cooperated with them. With a view to providing relief to the people who are in those areas.
We have to break for a minute, Ambassador, but then when we come back, I'd like to ask, what does Sri Lanka need right now from the world
Thank
community?
You.
Also standing online, we have a journalist and peace activist from India to talk about what is happening there. We'll also speak with the permanent representative to the United Nations of the small island nations. This is Democracy Now! As we deal with this global calamity. We'll be back in a minute. Droma Choiling and Steve Tibbetts here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, numbers now being talked about, 40,000 people dead, and the number is rising as the deadliest tsunami hits the Indian Ocean and the land around it, deadliest in more than a century. Our guest is the Sri Lankan ambassador to the United Nations, Bernard Gunatilleke. We welcome you to Democracy Now! As you're talking about what you need from the world right now, Sri Lanka, one of the hardest hit countries.
Well, when you take into account the magnitude of the disaster, people will require immediately food, shelter, and medicine. Within days, people will have to have access to clean water, for which government has requested for water purification tablets from the international community, because without such facility, people will be drinking contaminated water, and they will fall sick, and we will have another disaster in our hands. So we will require medicine, we will require clothing, we will require shelter material for shelter like tents and plastic sheeting, things like that. But taking into consideration the distance between, for example, the United States and Sri Lanka, the most desirable thing to do at this point of time is to provide cash so that whatever material required by the authorities concerned could be purchased either locally or from the neighboring countries and can be rushed to the victims as early as possible.
Mm-hmm. Your response to the Bush administration saying it will give $15 million. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs criticizing the U.S. for being stingy.
I do not want to comment on the statement, that statement, but the fact remains any government will have to first have to have information with regard to the magnitude of the problem. They will have to receive information from their own embassies, and having received that kind of information, they will have to decide what kind of assistance to be provided. And mind you, this incident took place only about 72 hours ago, and I'm sure the U.S. administration would need a little bit of time to understand the situation and to respond promptly.
Do you think 15 million is enough?
I'm not commenting on the 15 million. I'm commenting on the need to assess the size or the magnitude of the problem and then to respond accordingly.
What about this issue of the early warning, of not having the proper notification, a system set up for the Indian Ocean?
Unfortunately, we don't have a system of that nature, and I hope what happened 3 days ago would be an eye-opener for the countries in the region to come up with that kind of a system, which would provide the barest amount of time for people to evacuate and reach areas of safety.
I want to thank you very much for joining us here on Democracy Now! We've been joined by Ambassador Bernard Gunatilleke, the permanent representative for Sri Lanka to the United Nations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amy.
As we turn now to India, to Jay Sriraman, a journalist and peace activist who lives in the Indian fishing village of Chiang Mai, an area that's been devastated by the tsunami. Jay Sriraman is a frequent contributor to the Pakistani newspaper The Daily Times, to the website truthout.org, and wrote the book Flashpoint, How the U.S., India, and Pakistan Brought Us to the Brink of Nuclear War. Now dealing with another catastrophe, Jay Sriraman, can you describe where you are and how your country is affected?
I am speaking from Chennai, one of the areas hit by tsunami. As you would know, the south of India, the state of Tamil Nadu, of which Chennai is the capital, is among the worst hit areas. In this one state, there have been over 7,000 deaths so far. And as you said, the toll is rising all the time. And for the whole of India, the figures should have already crossed 10,000. So it has been a very terrible tragedy, and more than that, a totally unprepared for the tragedy. Nobody was prepared for it. As I have written in the truth out this morning, I think this is a tragedy we should have been prepared for. I don't agree with the official perspective that this was something that nobody would have anticipated. There are environmental groups here which have been warning of such disasters.
We're talking to Jay Sriraman. Can you geographically place Chiang Mai for us, where you are speaking from?
Geographically, it is the capital of Tamil Nadu in the south of India. You know, and I live in a place, let us say, 700 to 800 meters from the sea. So it's an area, it's very much a coastal area. So I happened to be an eyewitness to all that was happening. Even though, luckily, my area was not affected directly because the sea stopped just short of my area. But I was a witness to the panic here, and it was just lucky, I guess, that this area was spared. And this is the area, as I said, you know, it's on the coast of the Bay of Bengal, which has been known as a very gentle sea. This Chennai, which is formerly known as Madras, has a very famous beach called the Marina Beach, which is known for its very gentle kind of beauty, and you know, it's a kind of, it's our piece of paradise, as I wrote this morning. And it has been a very, very gentle place, and people have never known anything like this before. Just 3 years ago, the Madras Chennai knew some tremors. That was the very first time, I think, in living memory, that people ever knew some, experienced an earthquake. But that should have been a warning enough, but this warning was not taken very seriously.
What do you think needs to be done right now?
What could be done right now immediately, of course, what are called for are relief operations on a massive scale. Because the people affected, you know, are the poorest of the poor, mostly fishermen, and fishermen who put out to sea on a very ancient, primitive kind of craft, and who were bound to be drowned in this kind of a situation. They don't have even proper fishing boats. And people living in makeshift hamlets on the coastal areas, and they have all been dispossessed and you know, rendered totally, entirely homeless. So what we need, immediately need, is of course assistance to them on relief operations. But I think also almost immediately, India and the rest of this region start thinking about not only an early warning system, but also about protecting the coastal environment. You know, the whole region has almost lost its coast. You know, the coastal protection against the sea encroachment has been lost because of absolutely indiscriminate building and this so-called tourist industry, the five-star hotels all along the route. This has been done in areas where this has been prohibited. There are regulations which say they should not be built in these areas. But they have been violated in by the rapacious rich. And there's a greedy real estate people. And even the state, which is intent on making, easy tourist money.
We're talking to a guest right now in India, speaking about the tsunami that has taken place. Jay Sriraman is speaking to us from the village of Chennai, an area that was devastated by the tsunami. We're going to turn right now to the Maldives, to Tom Bergman-Harris, who is head of the UNICEF office in the Maldives, speaking to us from the capital.
The situation is worse than expected only yesterday. We have about two-thirds of the entire population affected, probably up to 100,000 homeless. 50% of them are children. Many people are being evacuated from their islands that have been either partially or totally destroyed. We have as the biggest problems lack of drinking water, food, and oral rehydration salts, because we already have diarrheal disease outbreaks. The UNICEF is working together with the sister agencies represented in the Maldives. We have had several meetings with the government. We are launching procurement of supplies for UNICEF, for example, that is food items, hygiene, sanitation, and other items, tents, clothes for children, because many of the people who are being have been evacuated have literally lost everything. They have nothing left from their belongings. They often have only the clothes that they're actually wearing. The biggest challenge is to bring in the resupplies as quickly as possible, because water, drinking water, is very scarce. One out of five islands has no longer potable water. The resources are destroyed. We have to be very fast in bringing in water and food supplies. These are the most important elements at this stage, and the speed is speed with which supplies are brought in is highly important. Apart, of course, from financial resources to pay for supplies.
Tom Bergman Harris, head of the UNICEF office in the Maldives, as we move from one island to another. Tuvalu, an island nation in the Pacific. The nation stands just 13 feet above sea level at its highest point. It faces oblivion if global warming causes the seas to rise. Residents say flooding is already coming right into the middle of the island, destroying food crops and trees, which have been there for decades. 2 years ago, the government sued the United States and Australia because they've rejected the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. We're joined right now by Enele Sopoanga. He is the permanent representative of Tuvalu at the United Nations. We welcome you to Democracy
Thank
Now.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the tsunami and how it's affected your own country?
Well, yes, certainly. The shocking and graphical situations in the Indian Ocean region have sent a very alarming signals, causing worries to my people in Tuvalu and also the island countries in the Pacific, particularly those which are totally atolls, completely flat, not higher than 3 meters above sea level. This have created a lot of alarming amongst the people, the communities, because knowing very well the situation that has affected the Maldives and low-lying coastal areas in the island countries in the region of the Indian Ocean could also happen to them in the Pacific. We can share very much the magnitude of the devastation that has been caused by tsunami in the region of the Indian Ocean. We share very much the plight of the faced by those people. Even though we are far away in the center of the Pacific, we can very well share the worries and the shocking situation that is being faced by those people in Maldives and some other island countries in the Indian Ocean.
People might be surprised to hear that an island in the Pacific is now affected.
Well, maybe not physically, but of course psychologically. And we have been worrying a lot about the impacts of climate change, for example, that have in fact impacted very, very badly on island countries. And we believe that disasters are now exacerbated by global warming and climate change. And we have had situations in the Pacific, for example, Cyclone Heta, that devastated Niue, the island of Niue, and completely thrashed the economy of the island and the livelihood of the people almost exactly 1 year to now. And many more, not only Niue, there were also island countries like Samoa, Tonga in the Pacific. Now we have more recent examples in other regions of small island countries, such as those in the Caribbean, for example. I mean, this just shows how vulnerable these island countries are and how unprepared they are and the lack of capacity they have And also the necessity of improving that capacity.
Do you think there's a link between global warming and what we're seeing, the devastation in the Indian Ocean and the countries around it?
The devastations do not distinguish whether it is earthquakes or global warming. It just happens, and it hits directly on the capacity, on the need to improve capacity of low vulnerable island countries. What we have seen in the past 2 days is a clear underscoring of the failure of the international community to prepare these countries by building their capacity in early warning systems. It's disgrace for us to know, find out just now, to realize after 40 years of the latest, as serious earthquake as what just happened 2 days ago, that the Indian Ocean is not included in the international early warning system.
I want to ask you what exactly that early warning system is, but we have to break. When we come back, we will continue with the permanent representative of Tuvalu at the United Nations, Enele Sopoanga. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Bardo Pond, every man here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, NPR stations, on public access TV as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. As we talk about what is taking place around the Indian Ocean, the devastation now, the death toll topping 40,000 people, the areas particularly hardest hit, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, India. We're joined by the UN Permanent Representative of Tuvalu, Enele Sopoanga. He joins us in our studio now. The early warning system, for people to understand what exactly that means.
This is, of course, a capacity to observe the climate systems of the world and try to give out a warning and improve weather forecast. What we have in the Pacific, of course, supported by a center in Honolulu, in Hawaii, is a system that helps us get early forecasts of weather and, of course, warning as well about the weather systems in the islands. This has been very helpful indeed.
How does it work exactly?
I don't know exactly the technicalities of the system, but it does create a network that provides information throughout the islands. And this is very, very useful given the fragmentation and the isolation nature of the islands in the Pacific. It is, we understand there is also a center in Alaska that provides this system and, helps to improve and maintain the system of warning, giving weather forecasts and warning about cyclones and hurricanes that might be approaching your area. Now, of course, be that as it may, it does require infrastructure as well at base, for example, on each of the islands, proper infrastructure to be able to make use of the information transmitted by these centers.
So these Pacific islands have it, but those islands in the Indian Ocean and the countries around the Indian Ocean had none?
We understand, I understand the Indian Ocean region is not included in the International Global Early Warning System. That's the information I have. But as it has been shown in the past 2 days, those countries which were not were hard hit were not given early warning and are not included in the warning system.
I want to turn to the issue of global warming, though perhaps not directly affect a cause here. It is certainly a cause you have taken on as the representative at the United Nations of Tuvalu and also representing small island nations. Can you talk about your lawsuit against the United States?
Well, the government and the people of Tuvalu are still considering it, the lawsuit. As bringing in, drawing in the rights of the people to exist and the injury that climate change has caused on the existence of people of Tuvalu. Of course, this is an extremely complicated issue, and the government is still considering it.
What is it? How does climate change affect you, and why is this so critical? Why do you hold on to Kyoto?
It's so critical. As I was describing earlier, Tuvalu is totally flat. It's an atoll island country, and the sand is very porous and it's gravely threatened by sea level rise. Now, we do get swells now and again, and of course the sea water is seeping through the soil increasingly, destroying the water, freshwater lenses, and also food crops. Now, and at the same time, it's causing serious erosion on the foreshore areas of the island country, of the islands. This is also happening in other island countries in the Pacific. So it is indeed climate change is a serious issue. We know that cyclones, hurricanes are exacerbated by the effects of climate change, and also is causing a serious coral bleaching, which is a source of livelihood in the sea. So it's really serious, and that's why we have been following very, very closely the process of climate change under the Convention on Climate Change. And, of course, now under the Kyoto Protocol that is due to enter into force in February.
What does it mean that the U.S. has unsigned the Kyoto Protocol, is not endorsing it?
It's unfortunate because, you know, a country such as the U.S. that's contributing about 25% of the CO2 greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere, not to participate in these global efforts, it does create some concerns. It's unfortunate, but we hope that the U.S. would consider signing on to the Kyoto Protocol. We certainly believe, with the participation of the U.S., collectively, the international community can make a difference and, help reverse the situation against climate change.
In the small island nation organization that you represent, how many small islands are you talking about?
You are referring to the Alliance of Small Island States, yes. We have 44 island countries who are members of the Alliance of Small Island States. And those island countries are in the Pacific, in the Caribbean, and of course in the Indian Ocean regions, and some of course in the South and Western African continent. And this is a formidable grouping. Our main common concern is to address the vulnerability of small island countries against particularly climate change.
Mm-hmm. You've also taken on Australia in addition to the United States. Can you talk about Australia's stance?
Well, I mean, Australia is a significant contributor as well to our greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere, and we want Australia to sign on and be party to the Kyoto Protocol, because this is a global effort. It does such a serious issue as climate change calls for the participation of all nations of the world. Only by working together that we can address this global problem.
Can you graphically describe what exactly does it mean when sea level rises for your country? What does it mean? How much does it have to rise to devastate the island and the other islands that you represent, the small island states?
Indeed. Any slight increase in the level of the sea will seriously affect the livelihood of the people living on islands. Scientists have predicted that over the next 50 years, the level of the sea could rise up to 2.9 meters, which is quite big for an island country, which is hardly 3 meters above sea level. Now, of course, the sea doesn't rise calmly. It does exacerbate and accelerate the impacts of waves, of strong winds and cyclones. So it does mean serious economic, environmental, of course, and social impacts on the island countries, such as Tuvalu. And, of course, not only impacting on the foreshores, but it's coming through the water lenses and, of course, affecting badly the food crops, which is the main source of living of the island. So it's really serious issue. And we have worked very, very closely with like-minded countries of the world to try to address this issue. So what happened just 2 days ago, hitting Maldives, for example, does clearly underscore the necessity and the urgency to move beyond the problems of definitions, of hesitations, of uncertainty, and try to build the capacity of these vulnerable island countries to be able to cope with these disasters. Had the infrastructure in Maldives, for example, been put in place, had the people been more prepared, we wouldn't be talking about losses of lives by now. It's so ironic that we, at this age, we are talking about gadgets, technological gadgets, and all sorts of innovations that we have not put in place the capacity to address the vulnerability of these island countries and poor countries in the Indian Ocean. I personally feel this is, we should be ashamed of ourselves. We should be ashamed, a world should be ashamed of itself, to living parts of the islands, of the world, particularly those are most vulnerable at this level of situation.
The United States, the Bush administration has said it will give $15 million to the effort. Your response to this, Ambassador?
I think, of course, the gesture is appreciated, but If we focus on preventative and building capacity, to address the vulnerability, instead of hesitations, instead of looking for definitions of these disasters, and of course including climate change, their hesitation to join the Kyoto Protocol, we would have saved lives much, much more than we are trying to respond now. Of course, you can give in any amount of money, but would that be able to return the loved ones of those people who have lost 40,000 in that region over 2 days? That would not, of course, it would help. But my point is addressing the vulnerability of these small island countries like the Maldives, the Seychelles, Mauritius, Sri Lanka, and those in Indonesia is critical to us, to the human race. It's better to prevent this by building the capacity, forewarning system, early warning system put in place, and you know, instead of responding. So, I mean, I cannot comment directly on the amount level. I'm sure the U.S. will still, contribute in other ways, continue to increase its contributions, and like also other countries. But the issue is addressing the vulnerability and building capacity for people to be able to cope with these disasters.
Ambassador, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Enele Sopoanga, the permanent representative of Tuvalu at the United Nations and representing the Alliance of Small Island States. As we turn from the ravages now of the areas around the Indian Ocean back to Iraq, a delegation of military family members whose sons died while fighting in Iraq have traveled to Jordan to deliver more than $500,000 worth of humanitarian supplies for refugees from the U.S. attack on Fallujah. The November attack, which virtually leveled the city and left some 2,000 Iraqis and 71 U.S. soldiers dead, also created thousands of refugees who are living without food, water, or adequate food, water, electricity, and health care. A number of the refugees are children. In an internet appeal, the military family members, along with U.S. peace groups and physicians groups and September 11th families, quickly raised $100,000 in donations. We're going to turn now to Jordan to hear from three members of the delegation that just made it there. Medea Benjamin, founder of Code Pink, Adele Welty, the mother of a firefighter who died on September 11th and joined us just before she left last week, as well as Fernando Suarez del Solar, the father of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq. We begin with Medea Benjamin.
We're here to bring humanitarian supplies to the refugees from Fallujah. We were very upset when we saw the U.S. military destroy the entire city of Fallujah. We know that there are thousands of women and children who are living without electricity, water, medicines. So we're here to bring supplies to them to show that there are American people who care about their lives and to say that it's time to stop the killing and help the Iraqi people.
I lost my son on September 11th at the World Trade Center.
Okay. How old was he?
He was a firefighter. And he he went to the World Trade Center to help rescue those who were caught in the towers. And he was trapped when they collapsed, and I don't want his name used to kill innocent civilians.
Adele Welty, Medea Benjamin, they are with Fernando Suarez de Solar, who lost his son in Iraq, and they have made it to the Iraqi border again, hoping to get supplies to the people of Fallujah. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Ryan Abernathy, and Mike DeFilippo, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.